My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of speaking with Kara Black. Kara, welcome back to KBOO. Welcome back to Portland.
Well, thank you, Ed. It's great to be here.
You've been here quite a few times now, and I'm happy to have you back again, because I think the last couple of book tours, you may have missed Portland. Is that true?
I have, yeah. But yeah. It's wonderful to be back, even in the rain.
Oh, Portland in the rain? That never happens here. The title of your latest book is Murder in Passy, P-A-S-S-Y, which again is another section of Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And Kara Black, your last name is spelled exactly like you might think it is. And it stars Amy LeDuc. Let me read a little bit about you. You're a best-selling American mystery writer. That's true. Best known for the Amy LeDuc mystery novels featuring a female Paris-based private investigator. You frequent little-known places in Paris, off the beaten track. This is true also.
This is true.
Best places to go in Paris are off the beaten track. Although I would have to say that the Church of Sacré-Cœur is not a bad place to be.
No.
Let's see now. How often do you go to Paris, or do you actually maintain a residence there for a while?
Oh, no. I go there twice a year for research. I sleep on my friend's couch in Montmartre. I'm really lucky to do that. Otherwise, I couldn't make it. But my research trips are going to the morgue, in the sewers, off the beaten track, the darker side. It's, you know, and Passy is very much off the tourist grid. Mm-hmm. It's very residential. It's part of this very chic 16th arrondissement, the kind of place where the maids wear pearls.
You know? Oh,
yes.
one's mind reels. Okay. I got to read the rest of this here. Let's see. You're a San Francisco library laureate because you live in San Francisco. What is a library laureate in San Francisco?
Well, I'm not really sure, but we were all invited to this big library fundraising they do every year, and they ask writers in San Francisco, and then you're a laureate, you know. Okay. But, you know, I always go to the library. Maybe that's also in all my unpaid fines. I was so nervous going to that banquet. I thought, I better pay all my library fines before I go.
Slap the cuffs on you and take you away in front of everybody. Okay, so one more thing. Your books have been translated to French, Spanish, Italian, Japanese, and Hebrew. Hooray for Hebrew. Okay, you were included in the Great Woman Mystery Writers book, so congratulations on
that.
Thank you. Let's talk a little bit about Amy LeDuc. She, interestingly about this book, we get some of her backstory. You've hinted at it over the years, and you've pulled away the curtain and then put it right back again. But we get a little bit more of that. We'll talk about that in a little while. She's a private investigator, but her job is really part of a computer security firm. Yeah, tell us about Amy.
Yeah, she is a licensed private investigator. But 5 years before, when her father was killed, who ran the agency, was killed in this mysterious explosion in Place Vendôme, she said no more criminal work. She hired her friend, René Friant, who's a hacker extraordinaire, and he's also a dwarf. And so they started doing computer security. But she does get pulled into crime, and she is licensed to do that. So,
now, the book is set in 1997. Why do you resolutely keep Amy back in the 90s?
Good question. People need to remember that everyone still paid in francs, that you could smoke in the cafes, and that Amy used dial-up. You know, this is pre-Google. And even the 11 books, it takes place over 4 years. And it's just a time that I got to know Paris very well and, you know, became more fascinated by what was occurring. Because in 1995, Jacques Chirac made this famous speech, you know, where he admitted the French collaboration during the Second World War with the Vichy government, which really made a crack in this wall of silence. So a lot of things were coming out. And that's a bit of a thread in a lot of my books, because that was so much of the time. But I also, you know, I live in San Francisco, as you know, and we have one season, which is fog. So I love writing about the seasons in Paris. So it's really kind of a chronicle of Amy's life, you know, every season, the new investigation. So 11 books, 4 years. I don't know. I kind of like the 90s. Mm-hmm. I like the fact that there's no Facebook, you know, or she has to tweet or anything.
So you like Paris in the summer when it sizzles and the winter when it drizzles.
Eh? Yeah, okay. Right.
Like the song goes. Are you running out of neighborhoods yet?
Oh, no, there's 20. 20 arrondissements. I've only done 11. So.
Well, that's not quite as well as A is 4 and B is 4, but it'll do for a while, huh?
Right.
Have you ever thought about setting one in the Beaulieu, suburbs, which are in so much turmoil nowadays around Paris?
I have thought about that. You know, I briefly touch on that in Belleville, Murder in Belleville. But, you know, I mean, that was happening at this time, but nobody really knew about it until CNN went there and started filming it. But it's been going on for years. And yes, I mean, mean, that is fascinating. There's a French author, Dominique Manotti, who's been, her few of her books have been translated into English. I think she won the Silver Dagger in the UK. She wrote a great book about that. And, you know, it's definitely, you know, a minefield of possibilities.
Yeah. I don't know how deep to go into this, but you touch on a ETA, the Basque separatist organization, which was declared a terrorist organization at some point in its existence. And it occurs to me that that's not all that far from what's going on in the suburbs in Paris.
Definitely, definitely. Well, the ETA are the Basque nationalists who are the militant, who are armed. And, even last year, the head of ETA was caught by the French police, which is amazing because they've been in the headlines for 30 years, you know. And originally when Franco, remember Franco who wouldn't die, the dictator in Spain?
Francisco Franco is still dead.
Still dead, yes. Well, you know, a lot of the people in the 60s and 70s would be part of this and demonstrate, and then they would hide in France. They'd go over the Pyrenees. Well, you know, France accepted them, you know, with asylum. But then when people started getting, French civilians were starting to get killed by Spanish police who came over the border, then things changed. But the ETA are still very much a presence. And I have friends who live in Bilbao, you know, in Spain, and Biarritz and Bayonne. And they are Basque. They call themselves Basque nationalists, but they have nothing to do with the, you know, terrorism or the militancy. I mean, they want the Basque country to be, you know, autonomous, to have their own, they have their own language, and to, you know, keep the history and culture alive. So it's really awful when I've talked to them how upset they are that the only in the headlines, the ETA are, you know, but there's so much more.
We could talk totally about this for a couple of hours. Anthropological studies, I think I read somewhere that the Basques are Celts and maybe the original inhabitants of Europe before they were raided by the Asians and by the Scandinavians and people like that.
Yeah. And their language is totally unique. There's no connection to any other language. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. Not even Breton or Gaelic or anything like
They've tried to find, you know, once they thought it was a link to Hungarian, mm-hmm. but then that never really panned out. So it really has no links to any other language.
Well, we're getting ahead of ourselves here, really. Okay. Aimé has a godfather named Morbier, and Morbier is a cop. He's a bit of a loose cannon. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, he's prickly.
He's prickly. He's made a lot of not so good enemies over the course of his long career, but something good is about to happen to him. Why don't you set up the book for us?
Well, Morbier is called to this investigation in Lyon. We don't really know what it is, and he's got to go there immediately. And he asks Aimé to go to his girlfriend. He has a new girlfriend. Well, she's not new. He met her 20 years before, and they fell in love, a couple. Coup à foudre, you know, and
translate that for people.
Translate that, love at first sight.
Okay.
And very romantic. But then they got separated, different marriages, children. They met each other by chance. It reignited. And she's older now. Well, of course she's older, but she's of Basque origin. She's a haute bourgeoisie matron living in the 16th arrondissement, very different from before when she'd been very active in the Basque separatist movement. Time falls away and they've reignited. Her daughter's getting married. She's trying to organize this wedding.
Irati,
her daughter.
Great names, by the way.
Thank you. That means fern in Basque.
And the woman we're talking about, her name is Xavier?
Xavier Desley.
Okay.
And so he's begged Aimé to go to this wedding rehearsal party because he's worried about her. He has some gut feeling something's not right. And when Aimé goes, things don't turn out well. And, I can't reveal too much, I guess, after that.
This is right up at the beginning of the book. You don't mm-hmm. want to tell what happens.
Yes, well, Xavier's murdered, and Morbier is a suspect, mm-hmm. because was he really going to Lyon? And as Aimé feels that she needs to vindicate him, she finds things along the way that the evidence points against him. So for her, it's a book about, the murder touches home and trust issues. Can she really believe what he's saying when the evidence is saying the opposite and it's very contrary? So their problematic relationship gets strained.
Mm-hmm. Now, Aimé needs... She needs allies within the police force, but because Morbier is the kind of person he is, they're few and far between. Right. And in fact, there are people that may, in fact, be actively against them. A guy named Suffren, that's a wonderful name for him. Tell us about him.
He's kind of a, you know, Morbier passed him up for promotion, I believe, many years before. And Suffren never forgot that. And, of course, he's the one in charge of the investigation. So it's all stacked against Morbier. But Morbier is actually working on a police corruption case and his own. And he's kind of acting on his own. And his boss, actually, can we say that he passes away. So Morbier is kind of rudderless now. And of course, everybody in the police hierarchy wants to keep this stuff down and, you know, point the evidence toward Morbier.
Yeah. So. Milak?
Milak.
Can you tell us about him?
Well, he made an appearance in the last book, in The Murder in the Palais Royal. Of course, he was totally against Aimé, but he is an officer in the Brigade Criminelle, which is the elite homicide squad, particular to Paris. And, you know, he sort of comes around in this book, and Aimé tries to get information from him, but it's pretty dicey. And of course, the last thing she wants is to be involved with a policeman, a flic, as the French call him,
yes.
A cop.
Cop. Yeah.
And it's not really pejorative, people ask me, because it's just a cop. And of course, she's attracted to him and has to deal with that. Never easy for her. She likes bad boys, you know.
Yeah. Mm. She also likes running around Paris in vintage haute couture. She's always ruining these Dior dresses and these gorgeous boots when she's running around Paris. Yeah. Do you do that on purpose just to annoy people? Or?
Well, it was really funny. I did a signing in Paris at the Shakespeare and Company, that wonderful
little bookstore. Yes.
A man came up to me. He was very nice. And he said, you know, my wife reads all your books. I said, oh, yes. And he says, I read them, too. And he said, you know, I like Aimé because she never lets up and never dresses down. I said, can I use that?
Yeah. Good line.
Great line. But, you know, Aimé has this gene, which I don't have, but she can find these vintage couture things in the bottom of the bin, put them together as French women can, and look fantastic. And that's who she is. She's a bit edgy. She's kind of rough. She's often tactless, as Renee, her partner, points out. But she's very determined and she's very loyal, you know, and will go to the ends of the earth, I think. But
I've often wondered whether this alleged French female gene for dressing stylishly is just whatever they throw on, it looks great, so that becomes a style, or they really have some sense of style to begin with. I don't know.
You know, after many years of observation, I think it's how you put things together. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think a French woman has usually like a good pair of boots, a good bag, a nice coat, and a great jacket. And then it's the mix and the match and the throwing the scarf that they had and it just happens to be there and put it together. And that wonderful chic tousled look, you know, thrown together, this breathless kind of, and looking fantastic. Always red lipstick, too.
Mm-hmm. Now, the deeper Aimé gets into this murder of poor Xavier, odd things begin to happen. Things pop up. Mm. People pop up that she has no idea what they're doing there or how they're connected to the murder, because there doesn't seem to be any connection. One of them is Agostino. I found him very fascinating. Tell us about Agostino.
Agostino is a Basque painter, and he has been given this grant to work at the foundation near Le Corbusier's art foundation. And he's working on something for the Guggenheim at the Bilbao. And he's this wonderful painter. He was a friend of Xavier's long before, when they were demonstrating and they were students in Bayonne. And he's veered away from that because he had been imprisoned. And he is trying to work through the Basque nationalism through peaceful means. But, of course, the past comes up to bite him. And, you know, when I was writing him, I was thinking a lot of Picasso.
He reminded me of Picasso, the way he looks. Your physical description of him and his attitude toward people.
This kind of bursting with life man. You know, he was from the countryside and he brings all that, and he's a very earthy man. And thank you. I wanted to kind of capture
that. That's funny. That's just what popped into my head. Oh, this guy reminds me of Picasso.
Yeah.
Let me remind our listeners, speaking of reminders, that I'm speaking with Cara Black, title of her latest book. How many is this in the series now?
Number 11.
Number 11. 11. Murder in Passy. And it's published by Soho Crime. We meet a lot of very strange people in this book. There's a bar. Can you talk about the bar? I don't want to tread too heavily on the plot here, but she goes to a Basque bar. What happens in the Basque bar?
Well, what's really interesting is that there was a Basque historical presence in the 16th arrondissement. Where the Basque bar is, it's just up the street from the Basque Cultural Center that existed at that time. So she goes into this Basque bar because she wants to find out some information, which, of course, we can't reveal, and meets these very interesting Basque men who are talking, you know, almost with love about these olives from this part of the Basque country.
Yes, that's right.
And I thought that was really great because, you know, very much of food is a part of their life and about what they grow and cultivate. And I had this very long discussion with my friend in Bilbao, a Basque, you know, about I wanted to get the olives right, you know, because I felt it said a lot about, you know, their way of life and how they lived and how cultivation was important. And yes, this man that she, this two men that she meets in the bar. And of course, all the Basques, if you've ever walked into a bar in France or Spain, you know, in the Basque country, they're all, you know, these men, and they're watching pelota, you know, that handball game on the TV, and they're drinking that drink, and they're, you know, talking. And the minute you walk in, they notice you, and there's a silence for about a second because you're an outsider, and then they resume talking. But you have been noted, and you are an outsider. It's very, in a way, chilling, you mm-hmm. know.
And somebody makes a pass at her, too, which just seems, it was like he was going through the numbers. Okay, I really, good-looking woman walks in, I have to make a pass at her. I don't even know if his heart was in it at the time. Yes?
Right, yeah.
Let's talk about Amy's backstory. For those who have not read any of the Murder Inn books, tell us a little about how Amy... What her background is.
Okay, her mother, she's half American and half French. Her mother, an American, left the family, abandoned her when she was 8 years old. And she had been involved in a lot of demonstrations in the Sorbonne and the riots.
1968, when everything was falling apart in Paris.
Exactly.
Or coming together, as one might say.
Right. She was very much of that time. But the strange part was that her mother married this French policeman, Amy's father. And so that's an, you know, relationship I've never fully explored, which might happen later on. But when she left, and we don't know why, her father took care of her, a policeman, and her grandfather. And she grew up very isolated in a way. She was neither French nor American, neither fish nor fowl, kind of in that lone detective mold, you know, being an outsider. Raised by, you know, her father and grandfather, who did the best they could when her father had, you know, stakeouts. And so she grew up this way. And then when her grandfather founded the detective agency and then passed away, her father took it over and left the police force in very dicey terms. I mean, he was fingered for something he didn't do. So Amy took it over. She had been in medical school and couldn't take the dissections. I think that was what turned her off, and went to join her father in the detective agency. But she is, and she inherited the 17th century townhouse apartment on Ile Saint-Louis. And, you know, of course, it's got archaic plumbing and non-existent electricity, and it's this wonderful building. But, you know, slowly she's trying to fix it up. And she has a dog. He's a Bichon Frise, and his name is Miles Davis. But, mm-hmm. of course, it's Miles Davis, as the French say. And she has, you know, not much family. And she has not been raised by wolves, but she kind of doesn't know all the social cues.
She's been raised by cops, which
raised by cops,
which
yeah.
is maybe almost as bad. Yeah,
yeah,
they know how to speak and bathe and all that stuff, but they're pretty wild otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, she grew up at the kitchen table. They were playing poker and they were gambling, and she'd sit on some Morbier's knee when she was young and hear the talk. And so she's very well acquainted, and there is that old boy network, which she hates, actually, because her father was excluded after he left the force in disgrace. So, but she's also taller and thinner than me, and she has spiky hair, and she likes bad boys, you know, and always kind of dealing with men and relationships. But I have a lot of French girlfriends, friends who I meet after work in Paris, you know, and we meet at a cafe or a bar, and they're, you know, very smart, they're very witty, warm, great looking. And we sit down after their day at work, and then they start talking about this man who left them. And I'm like, oh, my God, you know, if a man leaves you, is there hope for the rest of us? I mean, but it's, I think that's a universal thing, and I think it's never easy for any woman. And I love that. I want to bring that feeling, I hope, to the character and her vulnerability as well.
Yeah. That's a topic of many a novel is where are all the good men and how can I keep one? And somebody needs to write it from the male point of view also, which is a lot of times men are totally mystified as to why a relationship doesn't work. But this is off topic. This book has a lot of characters in it, and one of them I found especially touching and amusing was a compliant taxi driver.
Oh, yes.
That Amy meets. This guy is having the time of his life. Tell us what their quick relationship is all about.
Well, she hires this taxi and she doesn't want to have a report made. So she says, can I just pay you by cash and not you won't report it? And she slips him some money and he says, okay. And he is, to me, he's one of those taxi drivers that I've often had the good fortune to catch late at night, who's got his dog in the front seat and who is kind of doing this working from 10 to 3 in the morning. And he's an older man. He's sort of old school, and he's got his George Simenon Inspector Maigret novel in the front seat because he's been reading it between fares. And he's just sort of your old kind of Parisian, your kind of salt of the earth. And he's thrilled that something exciting is happening, and he wants to party. He actually wants to do a car chase, remember?
Yes. Is there going to be a car chase involved? And she says, no. He says, oh.
Yeah. He's one of those taxi drivers that you really could go have a little drink with, too, in the meantime while you're kind of waiting. You know, one of those men who's seen everything and loves to talk.
Mm-hmm. Two of the things that go on in this book are corruption of police and corruption of revolutionaries, and I thought that was like a parallel track in here. It seems to be the way of the world, alas, isn't it? That after a while, you're tired of beating your head against the proverbial stone wall and just say, maybe I could make a few bucks out of this thing and go live in the country somewhere. How did this what made you decide to write about that particular?
Well, I hope this isn't too off topic, but last year I went to this thing by the French Tourism Board in San Francisco where they were talking about building the high-speed train from Paris. They wanted it to go to Spain, and they've been doing this for 10, 20 years. But they get to the border of Spain, and where you could get to Barcelona 2-3 hours or Madrid. But the Spanish have never been able to finish the other side because the Basque keep sabotaging it. And I thought that was fascinating. Why would the Basques sabotage it? And I started to ask a lot of people because you would think that would bring people into the Basque country and they would, you know, make money and they would have stops there. And I thought maybe, you know, what's going on? So I wanted to play with that and how people can use their lofty supposed political ideals and really for another purpose, you know, to line their own pockets, which I think, you know, we all know about here, but
having been in both Provence and Catalonia, most of the people I ran into there are very skeptical about progress. Anyway, they don't see it as necessarily a good thing.
Exactly. I mean, you can look at it. If there was a high speed train stop in the Basque Country, then it would become touristic and it would be kind of spoiled and become like a Disneyland. Or other people are like, well, you know, unless we're cultivating the land, what else do we have? You know, life is tough. So the young people leave the villages also. So you've got the villages with just old people. So there's a lot of, you know, it's complex, mm-hmm. right? Complex.
Yeah, Barcelona is a big city in every way, a modern European city, but it's surrounded by people who shrug at the thought of a modern European city. So there's a bit of a potboiler at the end here. You normally do potboiler endings, but this one is a real whiz bang. There's all kinds of things happening, and there's shots fired and people bound up in cellars and things like that.
This is true.
Yeah. Did you have fun with that? I mean, when you sit down to scope out a novel, did you just say, screw it, let's just have some fun at the end here?
Yeah, I really wasn't planning on that ending. I'm a seat of the pantser. I don't outline. I start with the sense of place and why would Amy be involved in Passy? Who would be committing crime there? And so I try to use this place as a character and what is something about it that fascinates me. And I wasn't really sure what was happening. It was also discovering the Passy reservoirs that really, I thought when I got a tour of it, I have to use this in a book. So sometimes the place suggests it as well. And I have to say that I had no idea the Passy reservoirs existed, these above-ground pools, 5 stories high, open, with the view of the Eiffel Tower behind them and fish in them. It's just totally surreal. Until my friend told me about it, a documentary filmmaker. And I said, you know, I was just desperate to get into those reservoirs. And so I think I was channeling Amy LeDuc, you know, figuring out how to do it. And so I did make an appointment with the woman from the Eau de Paris, the Parisian Water Board. And she asked me who I was. And I sort of fudged it and said, well, I'm an investigative journalist with the blah, blah, blah. I will not reveal the paper.
All writers are liars.
She bought it. I signed a waiver. I got a tour of the reservoirs, and it was amazing. And I went down into the bottom, the caverns, and when she was taking me around, she said, you know, there's some sinister things that happened here. And I said, what was that? Well, the French Gestapo, who were headquartered on the next street, would bring people here for interrogations in these caverns. And I said, why? And she said, well, you couldn't hear the screams from here. I knew I had to use that in a book. So that was a place that was suggested. But it really, Passy has these wonderful little enclaves of this village-like feeling and these kind of amazing, you know, like the Maison de Balzac, where Balzac wrote and escaped his creditors.
Yeah. Also, you mentioned in here, it's the book takes place in 1997, that Passy is where Princess Diana's automobile crash happened.
Very nearby. And the book takes place about 5 or 6 months afterwards. Yeah. So that's still, you know, in the news as well. Yeah.
See, the difference between writers and normal people is that if they go someplace that's very nice, they look around and they say, oh, this isn't this interesting. And the writer's always saying, how can I set a scene in this place?
Exactly.
How can I use this place in a book?
Exactly. Yeah. I felt guilty for about 5 minutes after, you know.
Why? Refused the guilt.
Yeah. I just thought, well.
So tell us what you're working on now.
I'm working on actually just doing the edits for my next book, and it takes place in the northern edge of the Marais. So the Marais is the 3rd and 4th arrondissement. I've written about the area of the 4th before. But this is the part near Arts and Métiers, which is this old cathedral that has a great museum inside. But just to the right, at the very tip of the Marais, in the most ancient part of the Marais, with 13th century buildings and the house of Nicolas Flamel, that alchemist, is a very small and the oldest Chinatown in Paris.
No kidding.
It's about 3 or 4 blocks big. It's very different.
How old?
Well, the Chinese that populated this area came over before World War I to work in the factories for the Frenchmen who went to be soldiers. So that's sort of when it dates. And these people came from Wenzhou, W-E-N-Z-H-O-U, the part of China below Canton. So they came over to work in France, and they stayed, and they were the first sort of immigrants. And they're very, very much entrepreneurial. This area, it's in these medieval buildings, but they have wholesale luggage shops, costume jewelry. It's very different. They are not political exiles like the others. There are 4 Chinatowns in Paris. And the other, like in the 13th, there's a lot of political exiles and different type of Chinese immigrants. But this is very entrepreneurial, very business-oriented.
Mm-hmm. There's another difference between writers and normal people is that no matter how indifferent a writer was as a student in school, afterwards, research just becomes so much fun that even if you don't use it, you're just happy doing the research. Of course, there's no exams, I suppose.
Yeah.
Please come back when that book is published. I've been speaking with Cara Black. Title of her latest book is Murder in Passy, P-A-S-S-Y. It's published by Soho Crime. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
My pleasure, too. Thank you, Ed.